With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi guys, today's episode is a very special one as we take a look back at some of our favourite moments of the series so far. This first clip comes from one of our earliest episodes, Does It Matter If You Can't Do Maths? Rick was especially passionate about this one, and here you can hear us discussing whether gender can have an impact on your mathematical ability.
Well, I think there are definitely differences in brains, and there's a difference between the way that women use their brain when they're doing maths and men when they're doing maths, for example. If you give the same problem to a man and to a woman, you'll find that in a male brain, the problem is solved in a very definite area of the brain, and actually the cells around that area are inhibited, so they sort of close down in order to maximise, I suppose, the energy that goes into that part of the brain. If you give the same question to a woman, this is an Australian piece of research, same question to a woman, you'll find that actually not only does that part light up, but other parts of the brain light up as well, which only leads us to know that women are very good multitaskers, I suppose.
Ooh.
Well.
Right.
This is pretty contentious.
You don't say.
Yeah. And the history of sort of looking for gender differences in brains isn't great, because fundamentally there's been an absolute desperation on the part of male scientists to uncover evidence of differences. But when you look back over that history, and they've really thrown everything at it, like everyone has tried every possible way of measuring differences, and a lot of it is ironically sort of quite innumerate, like there's weak statistical power, so people sort of claiming that they've found stuff when actually the evidence isn't really there, not good enough controls, misinterpretation of the data, just a load of it is just rubbish. But it's quite grabby, so it gets reported by the press quite a lot.
Yeah.
And it's just been sort of, I guess, like vigorously pursued across the ages. And in spite of that, no, when you look back at the stuff and you look at current research, there has been no conclusive findings. So no decisive sort of category defining differences have been found. You can see that there are differences as brain size increases with body size, and you can see that sometimes male brains are slightly bigger, but if you were to compare like a small-headed man with a large-headed woman, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference.
Mm.
Crucially, when you look at the brain of a child or like a baby, no difference. And what Gina Rippon, who we, do you remember, we met years ago at some science dinner. I was sat next to her and she was writing this book, which I think is called The Gendered Brain, where her whole thing is just trying to explode the myth of differences between male and female brains. You weren't paying attention. I found it fascinating.
Clearly not.
So she's done loads of research into this, and she basically says it's a load of old rubbish.
Right.
And she thinks that what is happening is that if you live in a gendered world, which we do, that produces gendered brains.
So that's about what I was going to say.
It's about the environment.
It's about how you learn maths, isn't it? And the expectations on you when you're learning maths, I bet.
Exactly that. And so, because boys and girls are just brought up in different ways with different expectations, that is what is accounting for any differences that you do see. So there's nothing sort of innate or intrinsic about any differences. It's all to do with the upbringing.
Wow.
Which is a really sobering thought,
actually. Yeah, yeah.
This next one is from our episode, What's the Fastest We'll Ever Be Able to Travel?, where, as a physicist, I was in my element. We looked at the limitations of rockets, how technology could change the way we're exploring space, and, of course, we talked about warp drives. Here's a clip.
And we're back. Now, where were we? Oh, we're about to get quite science-y.
So I'm going to blow your mind. Okay. And I mean, so we want to be able to move faster than the speed of light. Yep. I mean, that would be ideal for our, you know, can we, what's the fastest we can ever travel?
Well, and if you're going to get anywhere, like realistically, you're going to get anywhere interesting, you need to start picking up the pace.
Yeah. So, I mean, so relativity tells us if you accelerate towards the speed of light, your mass increases, which makes it harder and harder for you to accelerate anymore. So as you approach the speed of light, you basically run out of energy. It takes an infinite amount of energy to go any faster.
Yeah.
And that's why you've got this limit. But that limit only applies to things with mass. Now, if you take the thing that we call space-time, so, you know, the three dimensions of space we live in, and the time, obviously, that we go through. Yeah. Einstein put these together into this four-dimensional thing called space-time, mm-hmm. and this is what the universe is made of. And this doesn't have to obey that limit, because it doesn't have mass. So basically, what a warp drive does is you take something with mass, like me, and you cloak it inside a bubble of space-time, and then that space-time itself can move faster than the speed of light with you inside of it. So basically, what you do is you use energy, and this is now we're getting into general relativity. You use energy to deform space-time. So everything that has mass or energy deforms space-time a little bit. So around the Earth, the gravitational field of the Earth is basically because the space and time around the Earth is deformed by the Earth's mass. That's what the gravitational field is.
Yeah, so it's sort of like it looks like a well, if you like.
Yeah,
so stuff sort of rolls.
The classic is the sort of bowling ball on the trampoline, isn't it? And it sort of creates this deformation. And so we can do that just, you know, if we get a whole lump of energy or mass, we can deform the space-time behind us so that we actually stretch it out, which sort of pushes us forward. And we use the same kind of thing to deform the space-time in front of us, where we want to go.
Yeah.
And you try to squash it. So you can imagine like a slinky spring
extends
behind you and then contracts in front of you.
Yeah.
And then
a bit like watching like a leech move.
You know, yes, that same sort of compression and elongation.
Yeah.
And that basically, so it's not strictly, I mean, I was sort of thinking about this, it's not strictly within our definition of moving fast, because what you're doing is moving the destination towards you, effectively. But I'm going to let that slide, because I sort of think it works.
Yeah,
anyway.
And the upshot is that you end up at a place that is really far away.
Yeah. So you have
moved less time. So I think
fast.
It works. Yeah.
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 It's maybe slightly.
I think you've got to allow it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So has anyone designed anything that could do this?
Yeah. So, I mean, lots of science fiction writers have talked about this kind of thing. Because obviously, ever since Einstein came up with it, people sort of said, what could we do that? But actually, in 1994, a Mexican physicist called Miguel Albuquerque, I think my accent there was more Italian than Mexican, maybe.
I think the bigger problem was that's probably not his name, but yeah. I've always said like Alcubierre.
What did I say? Alcubierre?
Yeah, I don't know what I mean.
Yeah.
It was it sounded exotic.
Yeah. Anyway, so this Mexican physicist came up with a way of doing faster than light travel, or in that he sort of showed how you could do it. So how you take the equations of general relativity and you impose a big sort of distortion through mass or an energy, and that gives you the ability to kind of compress and extend space-time to give you that kind of fast movement through the universe inside this little bubble of space-time that you're in.
But is it in any way practical? Like, is it something that someone could look at and go, okay, yeah, I've got an idea how to build that?
Yeah, it's tricky.
It's a no, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a no. So this is theoretical physicists dicking about with ideas on blackboards, effectively. Yeah. One of the issues with the Mexican guy's scheme was that you need negative energy. So if you want to go faster than light, which you can do in theory, you need something called negative energy to distort the space and time in the way that it needs to be distorted to make that happen.
What's negative energy?
Nobody really knows. I mean, it's sort of a mathematical idea rather than a physical thing. So nobody's ever seen negative energy. We don't know how to create it. What happens is space-time is like rubber. So it's like it's got this tension, like a stretching elastic band. So if you want to stretch it, you have to put sort of energy in like you have to normally do it. But in the way it works, you have to put this negative amount of energy in. So it's almost like compressing it. But no, to compress and contract and extend it requires this negative energy. So it's a problem, right? Yeah. Engineering-wise, that's quite tricky.
So without negative energy, this is a non-starter. I mean, is anyone looking at negative energy and thinking, well, maybe we can create this summer?
Yes, they are. They weren't until recently, but literally in the last couple of years, there's been 3 or 4 papers come out that have actually shown new ways to sort of maybe get around the problem slightly. So this is what I asked Sabine to talk me through.
I should probably first clarify that it's still a really, really small group of people who's working on this. Like, if you look at the grand scheme of things, it's maybe 1 or 2 dozen people. And they don't work on it full time because there aren't really any research programs. So it's a really new thing. And my understanding at the moment is that this issue with the negative energies is still there. And I don't think anyone has a solution to it. But that's only for what faster than light warp drives are concerned. If you're fine staying below the speed of light, you don't necessarily have this problem. And now, some people may find this a little bit disappointing. You know, what's a warp drive if you can't go faster than the speed of light? On the other side, if you think about the problem that you started from, how can we go beyond the current propulsion mechanisms of spaceship rockets that we have today, then if you could at least get up to the speed of light, that would be pretty cool already.
Up next, Rick's getting heated about the animal kingdom as we answered, which endangered animals do we choose to save? With the help of the brilliant Rebecca Nesbitt. We talked about how colonial attitudes are affecting local communities, whether animals going extinct is a fact of life, and a whole load more. Here's a clip. All right, so if, in general, the animals we're saving are just the likeable ones, who's deciding which is the most likeable?
Yeah, I asked Rebecca this.
Who decides in conservation really needs to be reconsidered, because currently there's a few people often running wildlife conservation charities and then donors, sometimes the large donors, guiding this agenda. But there's a very colonial attitude, and I think we do need to have mechanisms for more voices to be heard. There have been some changes, not enough, but they are continuing in parts of Africa, for example. There's a move to involve more communities in decisions about conservation, but they tend to be within very narrow parameters. New Zealand is another example that there's now increasing recognition of the important role that Maori play in conservation, but when Maori are being asked to draw up conservation plans, for example, they're still approved by the New Zealand Department of Conservation. Western law still seems to sit above them. So we're working on this, but we really haven't reached the end point yet.
So basically, the West is dictating the global vision of what's important and what's not.
Yeah, which animals to save, how to save them. And that is really important, I think, because, you know, who decides? You don't really want a situation where it's just a few people running big conservation charities. It doesn't even make any scientific sense, I don't think. And the fact that it is, by and large, rich Westerners guiding the path and imposing their vision.
Because those animals are not in the West, are they? They're not.
No.
They're not. You know, they're in Africa, Asia, Australia, South America, I guess. Sort of,
and it's quite easy to see why the global South, on the whole, does not have a good relationship with conservation programs.
Yeah.
Because they're just imposed on them. And often without much thought given to how that's going to impact the human population. And so it's this sort of quite colonial attitude. And totally also, we'll come on to this actually, totally ignoring the fact that a lot of sort of indigenous peoples living in forests and ecosystems that we're talking about, they have this really rich knowledge about sustainability that we just aren't mining and not taking advantage of.
Yeah.
Just sort of coming in and going, you're going to have to move out of here now.
Yeah, yeah.
And
we're going to take over and look after this properly.
We're going to take over. And again, that is something else. I thought I was finished with being wound up, but I'm not, because we are obsessed with protected areas. So protected areas are essentially just places where you go, okay, we're putting a fence around this, metaphorical or literal,
yeah.
And any people are in here, out, and we're just going to leave it. And that's job done. And so I think this month, conservation leaders are meeting in China from around the world, and I think they're going to agree this. We want 30% of the Earth's surface to be protected by 2030, whatever. That's the target. And you're like, well, that sounds good. But when people actually look at protected areas, they're like, well, you're not doing anything in them. You're just sort of leaving them. And like that's job done. And it isn't. And they're not effective.
Right.
It's just sort of...
So it sounds like you're doing something great.
Sounds like you're doing something fantastic. And actually, you're not. And so when you look at... people have looked at restricted to sort of wetlands and birds, actually water birds. So you've got to be slightly careful about how much you extrapolate. But when you look at the populations of water birds in these protected areas versus the same species in unprotected areas, it's no difference. Doesn't have an impact. You're like, well, so what are we doing?
Is that because they fly over the fence?
Yeah, well, presumably it's slightly harder to keep them in there. But it's just not being thought through. It just feels like it's just a good thing to say.
Yeah. So things get agreed at, like, you know, you have some summit, they sit around the table in the business suits and say, this is what we'll do. 30% by 2030 sounds good. Tell somebody to go off and make that happen.
Yeah.
And nobody's actually looking at whether that's really
impactful. Is that actively benefiting the wildlife? Don't know.
Yeah.
And then when you look at it, no, probably not.
Brilliant.
Not that it's not bad for it, but it's not particularly doing anything to to like grow populations that are in decline, for example.
Yeah. Okay.
What a load of bollocks. Everywhere you look in conservation.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah,
you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And then we're way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Now it's time for one of my all-time favourites from our episode, In an Age of Science, Why Do People Believe in Ghosts? We were joined by Professor Chris French to uncover the evolutionary advantages of getting spooked, whether science will ever stop people from believing in the supernatural, and why haunted houses feel so creepy.
Turn the lights on, stand in front of the mirror, and repeat after me. Bloody Mary, Bloody Mary, Bloody Mary.
With those words, many of us have our first experience with a ghost. Or not. We all know someone who is convinced that ghosts exist. Old, troubled souls lingering in the corners of pubs. Poltergeists running through households wreaking havoc. Or old sailors roaming the sea on terrifying haunted ships. They make their way into timeless stories that we hear again and again. And if you believe the dead can return to contact or haunt the living, you are not alone. It's an inevitable part of human life to be curious about what comes next, and ghosts have become a recurring theme when we think about the possibility of life after death. The ancient cultures of Egypt, Greece, Rome, China, India, and the Celts all feature ghosts and spirits. But is there actually any proof that they exist? And if there isn't, how can we explain those spine-tingling experiences? That's why this week we're asking, in the age of science, why do people still believe in ghosts? What is that? Oh, that's amazing. I've just read the... that's Michael doing... There's just a note from Katie, our producer, saying...
Scary noises.
Do some evil laughs and screams to go on.
I can't scream like that, can I?
Yeah,
I don't know.
Of course you can. Go on. Ah! And now do an evil laugh. more evil, please.
More evil.
Ooh. More evil.
I can't do that.
And could you do? You've just been molested by a ghost. So scream appropriately.
By Satan himself.
You've been molested by Satan. Yeah.
Ooh.
but Satan's a big boy.
Oh.
Ah! I mean, this. This
you're enjoying this. Is this doing yeah, I mean, you after admitting that I'm a real doctor?
Yeah.
Finally, you're getting your own back now.
Well, there we go. That's Dr. Michael Brooks. PhD
available for auditions.
Quantum physics. So, as ever, we've recruited an expert to help us answer today's question. We're going to be speaking with Professor Chris French,
excellent,
who's a professor of psychology at Goldsmiths, University of London. His next book is going to be called The Science of Weird Shit, and that focuses, which is a great title, focuses on anomalistic psychology, which is essentially the science of weird experiences and beliefs. And I genuinely was excited to speak to Professor Chris, because his work is just, it's all about trying to explain extraordinary phenomena, but in like with a scientific approach. Like, it goes in with an open mind.
Yeah.
He's not trying to debunk stuff, really. He's just trying to explain what is going on.
Yeah.
Because in most cases, something is going on. It's just probably not a ghost.
Perfect.
Spoiler. So we started off things quite simply with Chris, just by saying to him, what is a ghost?
What a ghost is, basically, I think the most standard definition would be the idea that when people die, some aspect of them, call it their soul or their spirit or whatever you want to call it, actually may remain on the earthly plane and still interact with the living. So some people would make distinctions between different types of ghosts. In particular, lots of paranormalists would make a distinction between those that can actually interact with the living, as opposed to another type, which is more or less just like a kind of video replay of some event, but without actually any interaction. And I suppose also we should point out that some ghosts are referred to as poltergeists. These are the ones that cause lots and lots of destruction, be it kind of throwing objects around, starting fires, interfering with electrical equipment, and so on and so forth. I think you get a little bit too kind of bogged down with these different distinctions. Basically, ghosts are the spirits of dead people.
Yeah, the spirits of dead people somehow still interacting with the living world.
Especially if they're poltergeists.
Yeah, so poltergeists are the cheeky ones.
Little bastards.
I like to imagine that if I'm coming back, I'm coming back as a poltergeist.
Yeah, I mean,
I think I'd be quite a good poltergeist.
Yeah, I mean, but
you'd just be a bog standard ghost.
No, I think everyone wants to come back as a poltergeist, don't they?
I agree. I'm just saying I would, and I don't think you would.
I think I would. I would.
You're but, not
I
mean, coming. You, no.
What do you think I'm
square.
Coming back as?
You're a square.
Oh, do me a favour.
You
really?
Are, come
I'd be
on.
Far more inventive as a poltergeist than you would.
No, no. I don't think you've got the naughty streak. You didn't get in trouble at school, did you?
No, I didn't.
There you go.
No. No, you're right. Maybe I won't.
You're just a bog standard.
I'm not even going to bother coming back.
You're a white sheet job. Boring old white sheet job.
I'll tell you who will be back as a poltergeist.
Go on.
Shane Warne.
Yes. And you'd be so delighted.
I mean, he'd come up with some great shit, wouldn't he?
To be haunted by Shane Warne.
Yeah, what an honour that would be.
Quite a good film in that as well, potentially.
Let's not talk about that anymore.
No,
let's
doubt.
Just make some notes.
Yeah. Any other, I'm now trying to think of other people. Interesting question. What would is the Duke of Edinburgh?
Coming back as?
Yeah, assuming he's coming back.
Scary. I mean, it was pretty scary when he was alive, wasn't it?
I don't think... I mean, honestly, in the last few, with obviously huge respect, the last few sort of months, years of his life, that guy looked like the living dead. he actually looked worse than a corpse.
You know how you get some of those ghosts in the stories are like highwaymen driving along, like, you know, like a horse and carriage and stuff?
I bet that
he would come back as just a guy who appears on the A27 in a Range Rover, just like in the dead of night. He's just driving down a ghost Range Rover.
Careering into innocent ladies?
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
I quite like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see it.
But unfortunately, we never hear about, you know, the recently deceased coming back as ghosts, do we? Nobody ever says, oh yeah, that guy who died last year, he's now haunting my flat, really. Well, I mean, I suppose Millie's like care home thing might be it.
Yeah, Millie is saying that is what's happening.
But you think there'd be a bit more of that, wouldn't you, of like celebs coming back?
The interesting thing is that sort of in the past, all of the famous ghosts were already famous people.
When they were, pretty much.
Which is odd because it sort of suggests there was loads of other ghosts knocking around as well, but no one cared because they weren't celebs.
Nobody even talked about them. Well, they didn't have PR, did they? So I guess that was, you know.
Yeah, because I guess that's the ideal thing. If you're a celeb and you die at the same time as your publicist,
or your agent,
carry on the great work in the spectral plane. But it is genuinely interesting when you look at ghosts sort of through the ages, because all cultures throughout time pretty much have had some sort of ghosts or spiritual component to their lives, or they've definitely thought that they had. Yeah. And you could look at that, I suppose, as a suggestion that there's something in it. That's not how I would look at it.
No. I'm looking at you blank thinking, really?
It's very consistent.
Yeah.
Although what is not consistent is what those ghosts are like. So what ghosts appear to be is more like a sort of reflection of the society that is talking about them.
Oh.
Which is what you'd expect, probably. Contemporary ghosts are quite sort of credible, sort of quite believable.
Right. In what sense?
Well, so back in the day, ghosts would be like sort of, like they have like hideous, like bleeding hands, like luminous skulls.
Oh, right,
stuff.
Yeah. Or be carrying their heads by the side of their...
Yeah, really sort of like terrifying and not, well, sort of human-ish.
Yeah.
Whereas modern ghosts are a bit more like they are just sort of like people. It's like people hanging around. And you've seen lots of these kind of changes, and they seem to reflect, what's going on in the society at any given time. Like, for example, ghosts in the 14th and 15th century were thought to be occupying purgatory.
Yeah.
And then in the Reformation, purgatory, which is quite funny, it just sort of got abolished. People are like, they obviously can't be there anymore. But it sort of stuck around as an idea. And then in the Enlightenment, ghosts went slightly out of fashion because people were sort of, really embracing science more.
Yeah.
Although the kind of romantic poets, I think, were around a similar time and they kind of kept going with it. But yeah, fundamentally, ghosts are sort of reflection of what's going on at any given time in any given society or culture. So they're quite fluid.
Right.
And if you sort of took a time slice and then looked at different parts of the world, the ghosts are going to share characteristics, but are going to be spoken about quite differently, and their appearance is going to be quite different. So it's not hugely supportive of the idea of ghosts.
Of you being like stripped of all your like life stuff, and effectively reduced just to your spirit essence. You seem to retain an awful lot of basically what you had when you were alive.
Yes.
This final clip is for anyone who's ever struggled to get to sleep. We asked one of the world's leading sleep experts, Dr. Mario Schadel, how can I get myself to sleep? We talked about how technology is affecting our sleep and whether hormone supplements can help us out. Here's Dr. Mario telling us about some of her more amusing research around orgasms.
We did ask Dr. Meyer about one very interesting piece of research.
There was a study back in 2019 that looked at this, although having said that, it was a self-report study. So this is not something that's been measured in the lab from what I can see, although I might have missed one. But generally, people do report that they sleep better and they fall asleep quicker if they have either masturbated or they have had sex that's led to orgasm. And the orgasm is the important part, apparently, for both partners. So generally, sleep gets better if both partners have orgasm. That's definitely something that came out of that study. And masturbation was also seen to be helpful as well. It's not something that we prescribe, but we definitely do talk to people when they ask us, and they say that actually I feel really relaxed after I have sex, that really helps, then of course that's going to help. There is also, we think there might be something to do with the fact that, during sex your heart rate is up, and as soon as you stop having sex you have this kind of really quick deceleration of your heart rate, and that's likely to be helpful. It also is likely to be helpful because of your muscles relaxing afterwards, which is what we need. But I imagine that there's something that's a bit more difficult to measure, which might be about the psychological impact of sex, which is about often people feel closer together. They feel that they have connected with someone. And I imagine that that feeling in itself is likely to contribute to why people find that they fall asleep quicker and that they have a better sleep, that they might just be feeling generally more relaxed and happy in themselves and in their relationship.
So,
so you've been married.
To unpick here.
You've been married a few years now, Rick. Is there everything all right? You know.
Well, the key thing here is, of course, I am living up in Manchester during the week on my own. So the only conclusion is I am going to be wanking myself silly every night. in the name of science.
Strangely, lube sales in Manchester have gone through the roof.
When Dr. Meyer said we don't prescribe it, all I heard was, that is what I'm prescribing. but it's sort of like, it makes sense because anecdotally, like the cliche is when men have sex,
as soon as they finish, they
roll over and they go to sleep.
Yeah. Obviously not in, I mean, not in our case.
No, I think I might do. But there's not, when these studies that have looked at it, there's actually not a, there's not a gender difference. So my take on this is probably, I mean, it's awful. It's probably just that when men have sex, almost every time they will orgasm, and that's not the case for women.
That would probably make sense, actually.
Yeah. But ultimately, it's the orgasm that is key. It doesn't really matter
how you
get there. Good to know.
It's
very interesting for me to know that, actually. and there's some other...
I'm going to text you at 5 to 8 and just put you off every night.
Oh, don't do that. Text me a photo of your horrible face. But yeah, it's interesting. I'll definitely... I'll look into it, won't I? There's some other quite funny studies around your sleeping companions. I think this is self-reported. So, you know, self-reported stuff, you always have to, you bear in mind, it's not as rigorous as it might be.
Yeah, people can brag.
Yeah, people can brag. People can sort of say what they think you want to hear, right, kind of stuff. Yeah. But anyway, they spoke to, I think it was nearly 1,000 women, and it turns out that their preferred bedfellow would be a dog. So they feel like a dog is a better sort of sleeping companion than a man. I reckon it's because dogs... are just sort of they'll sleep when you sleep. They're not gonna be keeping different hours to you particularly. If you're going to sleep, then the dog is happy to do that. Whereas if you think about like your human partner, they might get to bed later than you. They might be getting up earlier than you, so it's just a bit more disruptive. They might be thrashing around more,
snoring louder.
Although I think dogs probably snore.
They do a little bit, but not like I can.
No, sure. Cats also not as good. So it's definitely dogs. So dogs are the preferred. Sleep companion.
I wonder if there's an element of feeling safe and protected as well.
Possibly.
Because you're not going to get that from a cow, are you?
Not really.
Burger comes in, the cat's just like, I'm out. Yeah.
Well, no, the cats are not doing anything. The cat's just sort of sitting there and watching. It's not even vaguely phased. Like, well, I don't have any belongings, so take what you want. If he takes my food bowl, there's going to be trouble. But apart from that.
Thanks for joining me on today's episode. You can find the full episodes on the Eureka feed. You can also get in touch with the show on Twitter at EurekaPod. Be back with you next week.
Eureka is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces 3 thought-provoking questions over 3 glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah,
you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.